excision number 13232, reel 4.
Major Campbell, reel 4.
They were not trained in the methods of infantry on the march on the road. In fact, what one could say was that they were just a rabble carrying ammunition and small arms from one site to another. However, it so happened, so I'm told, that during the course of this so-called march, General Wavell and some of his staff passed them in his motor car, and he said that he had never seen such a disgraceful exhibition by an Indian regiment in his life. And this didn't go down too well with the Indian Army, I can tell you. This was not thought one of the most tactful things for anybody to say. However, I suppose it can go into the archives, and he was probably under great pressure, and he hadn't been informed that it wasn't anything such, but I thought perhaps he might have recognised from the people he saw that they couldn't have possibly been military personnel. However, having said that, we were then sent up and we were amalgamated with the 5th, 11th, 6th under Colonel Parkin in the central area. And I suppose it would be right to say that at that point the line stretched, or was thought to stretch, from just west of the causeway where the mangrove swamps were, where the Australians were supposed to be defending it, across the island in one red line, right across as far as Changi, and reinforced in the central zone by further troops, and our composite battalion was in the reinforcing zone, and we were not far from the Bukit Timah Road, and we were not far from the racecourse, and we were hanging about there. And I remember one pleasurable moment when we were waiting to move over into a position, and we were sort of resting, and I came across a Beaufort's gun battery with a very pleasant gunner sergeant in charge near the edge of the racecourse, and I said, you know, I'm intrigued with these things, I've never seen one actually working. Well, he said, you hang around here, sir, for a bit and you might have a chance. Well, it was all loaded up, and a few minutes later he said, here they come, and flying low at about 500 feet came about five or six Japanese Zero fighters, or their reconnaissance planes, which were twin-seaters with a rear gun. I think they were there. Anyway, he said, you watch this now, sir. And he hung on for a bit, and when they were about sort of half a mile off, he said, fire, and they really let them go, bang, 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 bang. And the Zeros just went up and over and turned over and went again. And he said, well, you see, they don't like them very much, do they, sir? Well, that was interesting for me. And then we moved into our positions. Battalion headquarters, Colonel Parkin and the main body of troops were near to the Bukit Timah Road, and then there was a long valley running down from the racecourse. And I was told to take my company over and occupy a small hill on the other side of the road, and I was given information to believe that the some troops from the Manchester Regiment, who were a machine gun battalion, were supposed to be on my right. And I had all these raw recruits and a Nike, who was now acting as my Havildar Major, and there was me, and we were the only two people who could fire a Bren gun. Anyway, this was a splendid house. It had been occupied by a member of the Legislative Assembly. I don't think it was Duff Cooper, but first thing we found was a 500-pound bomb crater in the middle of the lawn, and then we went into the house, and they must have gone, although I imagine to have been commended to go earlier, had not done so, in a very great hurry, because the whole house was open, all his papers and documents were all over his desk in his study, there was an enormous billiard table in first-class working order, there was an enormous great sort of larder which was filled with alcohol of every sort and description and boxes of chocolates. Upstairs in his dressing room there were about 50 store suits completely untouched, and up in the main bedroom was all her jewellery and dresses in the cupboards completely untouched. Well, the only things I was interested in was, having mainly Muslim chaps with you, they weren't interested in alcohol, but I thought they might like some sweets or something, and I dished those up, and they had those, and I showed them what positions I wanted them to take up, and then they could rest and just posted some sentries, because clearly nothing was happening at that particular moment. And it wasn't till later, in fact it was after dark, that things began to happen, because down below me, on the corner of the house, there was a sort of little shed, and in that I think it piled up the grass mowings or something, and it was a steep bank down about 150 feet, and at the bottom I put a listening post, because I thought at night things coming up a valley can be seen better from below than looking down from the top. And I said, if you hear anything, you should just call out and let me know, and if anybody approaches you, you should challenge them. And suddenly we heard an awful racket down in this valley, and I thought, God, they're coming, and I hadn't heard anything from down below. So we got the Bren gun out, and we let about 15 or 20 rounds of tracer go down the valley. And there were great shouts of stop, stop firing, stop, stop. Well, it had not been unknown during that campaign at intervals the Japanese had used English voices to try and put people off. Not very good English, but enough, you know, short bursts to make people think twice, are we shooting the wrong people? Anyway, they said, we're British. So I said, OK, send two chaps forward, come forward, and we're recognised. And they went to the listening post at the bottom, and they were sent up the hill, and I said, what the hell's going on? Oh, they said, we're a platoon of the Norfolk Regiment. Well, they were immediately in the forward bulge, you know, of this protective line, I was saying. And I said, what's happened? And they said, oh, God, it's been chaotic. They said the CO called a battalion conference, and all the officers were present, and suddenly into the room burst a chap in British uniform and was about to open fire when the adjutant noticed he was Japanese and shot him dead in the room. In front of them, he got past all the sentries and everything, and the next thing was they were attacked by tanks, and the thing in front of them collapsed, and these chaps that were coming up my valley were some of the remnants of this attack. And so I said, well, I'll tell you what we best do, bring them all in here, put them in the house. If anything really goes wrong, I want you to put your chaps out there here. It was a platoon, I think, with a subaltern out there, tell them to get some rest. Here's a bottle of whiskey between two men, and I skinned the larder and gave them. I thought I'd rather keep them, you know, quiet than doing anything. So all was quiet. About 2 o'clock in the morning, an officer from my regiment, well, he was a chap who was attached to the regiment, he'd been, I think, he was a Malayan rubber planter, and he'd probably been in the Malay States Volunteers. Anyway, he appeared, and he said, I've got a message for you. And I said, what's that? And I said, we'd better go into the loo, which was blacked out, and we'll read it in there, because everything else was black. And I said, well, this is absolute cock. I said, what the hell is this? You give me a reference point here to be at a rendezvous. I said, that was 2 hours ago. I said, how the hell am I supposed to get there now? I don't know, says he. He said, I suppose, you know, you better have a go. So collected everybody together. And I said, do you know the way? Yes, says he. Well, we go down in the dark and we get down to the road at the bottom, and it led off there into a 5.5 road, 4 or 5 roads coming in. And I said, which way now? And he said, God, I'm lost. I said, you bloody fool. And we were down in the storm drain, grovelling about on our knees, trying to read this map with a torch. And so I said, well, I think we better go this way, hadn't we? So we went about 100 yards, and suddenly a voice out of the dusk said, "Halt, who goes there?" And I gave my recognition signal, whatever, I thought it was the right thing to do, and he said, "Come forward," and I found myself confronted by another rank on his own with a pistol, standing by an anti-tank gun, no crew there. And I said, "I want to know the way to brigade headquarters." Oh, he said, "Well, if you go down there, so around there and up there, you'll get there." So off we trudged, and I'm leading my chaps along, past a house near the road, where the snoring was so loud that you could have heard it the other side of Singapore. Absolutely no sentries or anything, and nothing between them, as far as I knew now, and the Japanese. So off we go, and I got to brigade headquarters, and I said to all the chaps, "Look, sit down here, wait, I'm going in to find out what we're supposed to be doing." So in I go to brigade headquarters, and this is a large bungalow, and sitting inside are numerous appendages, or staff officers or something, all drinking coffee and smoking, and up comes the staff captain and says words to the effect, "What can I do for you, old boy?" I said, "I'll tell you what you can do for me." I said, "I want to see the brigade major, or preferably the brigadier." And he said, "Oh, you can't do that." He said, "They're in a conference. You'll have to wait." Well, the brigadier, I don't know who he was, this local brigadier, but the divisional commander was a, I think, a well-known ex-Dunkirk veteran, Major General Beckwith Smith, late of the Grenadier Guards, or one of these famous regiments. Anyhow, after about an hour or so, nothing was happening. I said, "Look, this just isn't on." I said, "You don't know what's going on out there, do you?" I said, "I've got to see the brigadier." So he went off and came back and said, "Well, you better go in." So I went in and sort of crashed my feet down and saluted, and there was the brigadier and the brigade major and the general there, and there was this enormous great map which I've described to you, with the red line across it and the blue line behind it. And the general said, "What's the trouble, my boy?" Well, I said, "Honestly, sir," I said, I think you ought to know that I don't think there's anything between you now and the Japanese, because I said, when we tried to contact the battalion on my right, the Manchester Regiment, I said, they'd bargoed." He said, "What's that mean?" I said, "Well, in Indian parlance, sir, it means they've run away." "How dare you, sir," he said, "say that British troops run away. They never run away." So I said, "Well, I'm awfully sorry, sir, but whether they've run away or not, I don't know, but they're not there now." And he said, "Why are you here?" Well, I said, "I got this message." Brigadier took it, he looked at it. "Where'd you get this?" I said, "It was brought to me by a runner, officer." He said, I didn't write it." I said, "It's got your signature on the bottom, sir. Who did write it then?" And then there was a stone bloody silence. And there was a sort of good deal of huffing and puffing. And I was told that I'd better go back whence I had come and try and re-establish the position. Well, I didn't know by then whether the Japs were there or not. I had no idea. So I thought, I'll compromise here. I won't go back to that position, but the next position is Colonel Parkin, and I'll go and report to him. So back we went, down past the sentry with the anti-tank gun, and we hit the Bukit-Timah Road. Well, there was sniping going on all over the place. I mean, bullets were whistling everywhere. I mean, you know, you might have got one, you might never have got one. And we were going up this road, and I said to this colleague of mine, yes, I had got a British officer with me, and I said, there's something going on down in that storm drain, so, God, I hope it isn't the bloody Japs. So we tentatively took a grenade out and a pistol, and we went gingerly over to the edge of this storm drain, and I thought, I'll probably shoot myself first rather than them. Looked over the edge and said, "Who's down there? Come out." And at least a dozen chaps, I should think, stood up. And I said, "Who the hell are you?" "Norfolk Regiment, sir." Well, that's the same story I had heard from the original lot, you know, how they'd been blasted through and they were now going backwards. So I can really say that that was probably about, within my recollection, what happened next, I don't remember, but I probably went back to battalion headquarters. That was one of the nearer last incidents for me of the Milan campaign. I remember at one other point we were pushed into the line somewhere else, and we were down in a sort of fearful sort of area of low-lying long pampas grass, and no one knew whether the Japs were 10 yards away or 2 miles away, but there was sporadic shelling going on, and you never knew where your shells were going to hit you, or the enemy half the time, or their shells were going to hit you. Because they did, actually, immediately after the surrender, three chaps got out of a slit trench and they were immediately killed by a Japanese shell after the surrender. But that's about it.
You were telling me earlier about encountering Australian troops.
Yeah, that was actually when we were being pushed up. That was immediately prior. You know, I described how I had this chat with this Bofors gunner. And he said, "You watch this," and they took some pot shots at some Japs heroes. Well, it was when we were moving up from the reinforcement camp to go into that area that we encountered these Aussies coming the other way.
How many of them were there?
Hard to remember now, but I should think certainly more than a platoon and probably rather less than a company.
What did they say to you?
I said, "What the hell's going on?" And they said, "You don't want to go up there, mate." They said, "It's bloody hell. We're off." Or words to that effect, and off they were.
So how were you actually captured? What was your first encounter with the Japanese?
This is very difficult to know, but an edict was, I think, given. First of all, that all Indian troops were to collect in one place and all the British officers had to collect in another place. And I think the British officers of the British regiments were also separated from their troops. And then everybody was systematically ordered to hand in their arms.
What was your first impression of the Japanese at close quarters? Did they surprise you or not?
Well, not in the least, really, no. I mean, one had had sort of sights of them during the thing, but to me they were just total uncouth savages. I remember, I think there was an incident earlier in the campaign sometime when some of the Argyles got overrun by the Japanese Imperial Guard Division, and they tied a lot of these blokes together, as I'm told, and poured petrol over them and set them on fire. And it so happened that during this incident, one of the Argyles officers thought he recognised one of the Jap officers. And indeed he did recognise him, because they'd both been at Oxford together. And this Jap officer actually more or less said to him, "I apologise for their behaviour." He said, "They're savages."
How were you treated at first in captivity?
At first, though, it was just we were herded together in Changi, and it was pretty boring stuff. We were just put in barrack blocks there. Meagre amount of rice and fish and stuff, and then we had what was known as the Salarang incident, about which you've probably read, have you?
I've heard about it, yes.
When they herded everybody onto the barrack square at Salarang, which had been a custom-built barrack area for a British battalion, concrete barrack blocks with a guardroom at one end, and they pushed thousands of blokes onto this square so that we were living on the square. Holes had to be dug into the ground, bore holes, you know, for lavatories and all this sort of thing. And they then issued an edict that everybody had got to sign a piece of paper saying they wouldn't try and escape. Well, there was a point-blank refusal by the authorities and everybody else, and they gave up in the end. There was nothing they could do about it. They threatened to starve us out, but I think they realised that world opinion and the International Red Cross weren't going to put up with that sort of thing, and in the end they caved in.
Can I ask you about the question of the defection of Indian troops to the so-called Indian National Army, you learnt about that personally at the time?
Well, it all started, as far as I know, possibly before the war, in the 1st 14th Punjab Regiment, where they had a number of Sikhs officers. And I remember the second in command of the 5th 11th Sikhs telling me in POW camp that when they were up in the frontier before the war, it became quite customary that if you had Indianized battalions anywhere, that there was a tendency for the Indian officers who'd been to Dehradun to find an Indianized battalion to go and stay with en route, you know. And his battalion was in Rasmuk, and the 1st 14th were in Banu, Railhead. And this chap, I think, was possibly a Pathan. But anyway, he asked if he could go and stay the night with the 1st 14th. They said yes, but then he went back up to Banu and he reported that he'd heard some very subversive talk in the mess there. And this was in due course reported to Colonel Fitzpatrick, I think it was, the CO of the 1st 14th, that these things were going on, and he simply didn't believe it. He wouldn't believe it. No, that sort of nonsense being talked about my battalion. Anyway, over they go to Malaya. And the leading light in the 1st 14th in this Indian National Army movement was one called Mohan Singh. And I think there were a couple of other Sikhs. There was also a very unpleasant Southern Irishman who was the signals officer, who was caught, I believe, actually transmitting information to the Japanese Air Force. And he was roped in. At the time, we were told he'd been shot on the spot, but I'm told by somebody else that he actually had control over him down in Singapore, and he was jailed down there, and he was openly boasting right up to the end that he'd get out and we'd all be inside. But I think this chap actually possibly, I'm not sure, whoever it was, actually put a bullet in him, just for good measure. I believe so. That's what I was told, but I've got no proof of that. Well, then you see, once we'd got into the bag, Mohan Singh and co. began working on Indian troops, and the Muslims would have nothing to do with it, the Pathans and PMs. But some of the brethren had great pressure put on them, and they decided to join, and they were made great promises, and unfortunately, this is absolutely true, that our Subedar Major, who was he'd had relatives in the regiment for years, he unfortunately went over, and as a consequence, after the war, he was up in the Red Fort at Delhi, and he lost all his jagirs of land and all his military decorations and everything out of sheer weakness. Others who stood up and suffered came out of it far better. But anyway, they formed them, I believe, into some sort of brigade and sent them to Burma. And when they came in contact with Indian troops on our side still, I think they got very short shrift. And I think they decided in the end that the Japs found that they just wasn't worth the candle. They were untrustworthy, and I think they gave up the uneven battle.
Well, presumably, whilst you were in Changi and whilst you were a POW, you didn't really know much about what was going on in this respect.
Not a great deal, no. On the other hand, we had got a news grapevine. I mean, the Royal Engineers had fixed up some splendid bits of equipment inside broom heads and things, and there was a sort of grapevine. It was rather like the mafia. Someone got the news, he told two people. Two people gave it to four more gave it, but nobody actually knew where the news actually came from. Although there were extraordinary incidents, I mean, in one camp, I remember someone telling me that there was a scare-up, and, "Christ, get that bloody wireless set out of the way, the bloody Japs are coming round." There was nowhere to go, so they ran to the loo. This chap went and sat in the loo. They were just an attap hut, you know, with a hole in the ground. With this sort of cobbled together radio set, which worked. There was a whistle or a call. It's all right, they're gone. Out comes a chap carrying this thing. There's a bloody great valve sticking out of the middle of it. And to his bloody horror, there's a Japanese soldier walking up beside him. The Jap looks into the wireless set. He sees all this stuff. And he says, "Cigaretto, no cigaretto, okayka," and walks off. They hadn't come to look for wirelesses. They were looking for people getting cigarettes on the set. And he did not even know what a radio set looked like.